think surviving traumatic experiences in the absence of other language systems to help you process that is hard. But artists often will gravitate to their own language system to process that complexity and find a way to communicate it, or not directly, but they have other language systems and tools that can be used as coping mechanisms.
Welcome to the Letters Podcast in our Arts Research Africa dialogue series. These dialogues are intended to stimulate practice, enable research, and inspire collective engagement around the question of artistic research in Africa. I'm Prof. Christo Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts. In this dialogue, I'll be speaking to Stephen Hobbs, a South African artist whose work spans a wide range of media, exploring themes of urban transformation, architecture, and social dynamics. Known for his thought-provoking installations and public art projects, Hobbs has a distinctive approach that often examines the hidden infrastructure of cities and the intersection of natural and built environments. Stephen has an exhibition, a survey of his career of almost 30 years, entitled Man Shouting in Distance, which is running at the Wits Art Museum until 23 November. I strongly encourage listeners in the Joburg area to catch the exhibition. Stephen earned his Bachelor of Fine Arts from the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg in 1993. From 1994 to 2000, Stephen served as the curator of the Market Theatre Galleries, fostering a dynamic space for contemporary art in the city. In 2001, he co-founded the Trinity Session with fellow Wits Fine Arts graduates Catherine Smith and Marcus Neustetter. Trinity was an artist collaborative and public art consultancy dedicated to integrating art into urban environments. Stephen's own artistic practice often explored themes of city infrastructure and social dynamics, laying the groundwork for his later explorations into the intersections of art, architecture, and the public space. Recently, Stephen has ventured into bio-art, working with mycelium, the root structure of fungi, to investigate natural systems that mirror urban networks. His innovative approach challenges us to reconsider the hidden connections that shape both our cities and our planet. In this podcast, we discuss Stephen's beginnings as an artist, his family background, education, and early influences, and how growing up in Johannesburg shaped his perspective as an artist. We go on to examine his strategies as an artist exploring the urban landscape and negotiating the complexities of post-apartheid transformations in the Johannesburg geography. We also discuss Stephen's interest in strategies of deception and camouflage and how these have manifested in his practice. We then explore the range of mediums that Stephen has used to express his ideas and how his practice has evolved over his career. Finally, we follow Stephen into a new terrain of practice, bio-art, in which he's been working with mycelia to explore the hidden connections between the structure of cities and the planetary environment. Useful links to Stephen's writings and the critical discourse around his work can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Stephen, welcome. Great to have you on the ARA podcast. Let's start with, how did you get to art? Can you tell us a bit about your personal journey, where you started, your influences, and what effect, what influence did growing up in Johannesburg have on you as an artist?
It actually pretty much starts in my mother's pottery studio at the age of three. So I was born into a family of artists, my mother a maker, potter, and so forth, my father a painter. His art master in school in England was Peter Blake, the famous British pop artist. My grandmother, passed now, was probably one of South Africa's most notable portrait artists, the only artist to do a sitting with Nelson Mandela for 8 hours, that kind of thing. Her son, a member of the Royal Society of British Sculptors, and produced monumental stone installations all over the world. I have carved stone with him in his studio in Pietrasanta and so forth. So in some ways, born into something I couldn't escape, but it was natural for me to follow that path of creativity. I was just lucky to have all these wonderful sort of talents around me. And it was inevitable that that's where I would land up, I suppose, making art as a key part of my life. I think in terms of influences, it's an interesting one because my brain tends to isolate itself sometimes. So you can read and you can research and so forth, but you can also believe in your own ideas. And that can be good and bad, because you can be so obsessed with your own inquiry that you might miss out from time to time that there are others who have done that. Not that that's necessarily an important thing if you are committed to that path and you do it on your terms. But the influences are myriad. Probably the biggest one would be Gordon Matter-Clark. I mean, I can't avoid the implications of his way of thinking in the 70s and how that resonates still today, particularly when one looks at a city like Johannesburg, where the amount of neglect and the number of properties or spaces or buildings are bare for kind of an artistic intervention or projection of sorts. And I think that's in a way important, because in the way that he approached buildings as material and really trying to understand these things as mediums to explore phenomena, his own body in relation to the built environment. He was actually a trained architect. He also, I think his uncle was Robert Matter and his godfather or something like that. He had connections to Duchamp as well. Anyway, Matter-Clark has really been at the center of it for a long time. And that genre of artists, I think of Alain Caprogue, Vito Conti, all of that kind of stuff. I think the land art space, early conceptualism and so on, is very important to me. But in a funny sort of way, I gravitated to that work a little bit later. In art school, I wasn't looking at that stuff. Yes and no, I was looking more at a kind of de-architecture where the artists, a Smithson as much as a Matter-Clark, would be in that oeuvre or that mode of thinking. But yeah, it was more a kind of state of mind I was interested in.
This was at Wits. Oh, yeah. And you talk about the art school. That was Wits and the Wedge.
Exactly.
Legendary Wedge.
Yeah, exactly. So I am thinking back to the early 90s and what was influencing me at that time, but it's just as much about music, you know.
And what music?
Well, you know, I grew up in the UK in the late 70s, so I was young. I was there from 6 to the age of 10, or I turned 10 when I just came back. And I was there from Joy Division to Madness, to Spandau Ballet, to New Order, you know what I mean? So in a way, there was something about, not so much punk per se, or New Romantics or any other thing. It was that zeitgeist of a radical moment in British popular culture that I think supplanted a way of feeling, an instinct for cheek and cockiness and a brazen kind of attitude to, I'll do it my way and I'm interested in that, you know? And then, of course, there's an aesthetic that comes with that as well.
And to focus more on your work in Johannesburg, and particularly the way that you've explored this urban landscape, and I think of how much of your work has drawn on modalities such as mapping as a way of engaging with the city, particularly in the post-apartheid period, which is when you really stepped onto the scene. Can you talk about how you've engaged with Johannesburg as a particularly complex, changing urban configuration?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of it is behavior and curiosity-based stuff and very circumstantial. So my first job after graduating was running the Market Theatre Gallery. So that meant from the suburbs of Johannesburg, I would drive into town every day and I would go in via Queen Elizabeth Bridge, that Sower Street intersection, and then come down to Newtown. So there was every single day there was an interface with the city in my city golf. And there was such a kind of phenomenological dimension to the driving, encountering, experiencing aspects of that, because one was all totally mindful of the fact that this was the first, it wasn't quite. I'd started on the 20th of April, 1994. We became a democracy shortly after that in terms of the first democratic voting. But that awareness of the transition of a city from a white-controlled, white-ordered environment where black people really were in service of, and then, of course, we know how apartheid spatial planning and the Group Areas Act posited people in an abstracted way into that place, became all the more interesting for me in the notional sense that the people that were now occupying the city had a right to that city in ways that they didn't before. And how they took ownership of that was particularly raw and rich at the time. So taking a drive down, I always forget, I think Bree Street's going up and Jeppe's going down. Anyway, so let's say I'm going down Jeppe Street. I was always amazed at the fact that people would be just crossing the road precisely as I'm, you know, traversing it. So there was always this battle between me and the pedestrian, almost like a bullfighter and the bull. Like there's a challenge between each other. Precisely that thing of driving the city, managing the projected fears about the city. Of course, the statistics of Joburg from a fear and violence and danger point of view were very true in some respects, but also very much it happens when the situation presents itself. It's not happening 24/7 to someone like myself, but it's a very real and violent place. And so that attunes you to a particular way of thinking of your body in space. What's inherited as these edifices of a colonial and apartheid era, and then what is really happening in the space between buildings, how people on the ground are really behaving. And we start to see that the identity, an African identity, emerging quite fast in the 90s at a time when the city is no clear governance from a metropolitan management point of view. This only really starts to manifest in the early 2000s with the likes of the Johannesburg Development Agency and all the entities that then made up the city and were responsible through their departments for managing it. There was a kind of lawlessness in a way and a frontier townness of Johannesburg at that time, which for me, being very kind of body-centric and body-aware, naturally led to notions of mapping. Where am I in space? And I'm not talking about an orientational sense of mapping. I was more interested in the disorientational experience of Johannesburg. The experience of a kind of fragmented society was perpetuated through the built form of the city. So an intersection is as much, from a planning point of view, a site of convenience for services and infrastructure and so forth, but it's also a collision space. And it's a collision space on any number of levels. And there's an aesthetic, I think, that one can, firstly, one registers, and it's a question of informality versus formality, new rituals, new practices, new smells, new textures. And I think that that's really radical, because you're driving through a town that you could comfortably always have owned in your day as a white person, privileged to have access to the city and others in service of it. And now you were aware that maybe that's not going to be quite the same anymore. You've got to negotiate very differently. So I think mapping is rooted in that. But is what kind of mapping? Is it cartographical? Is it sociological? Is it phenomenological? Is it perceptual? And I've tried to address some of those modes in my own sense of mapping.
Then you were instrumental, together with Catherine Smith and Marcus Neustetter, in setting up Trinity. Seem, could you describe what the Trinity session was?
So we started out as an artist collective, an entity concerned with self-organization, and within about 3 or 4 years we became a consultancy of sorts, offering services from curation to public art management to research to the clients that presented themselves at the time, and today probably primarily still really a public art spatial thinking practice.
I thought one of the great Trinity curatorial project was curating the artworks on the walls of the Big Brother house.
You know, those were the days. It's interesting you bring that up, because that's probably where we got to the public art thing. Yes, in 2003, I can't remember how it came about, but we were approached to produce the artworks for the Big Brother house, which I think was in its second run at that time. And we got into that because our mission as the Trinity Session in those days was to make art visible. There was no gallery. There's not what we have today. We have a full-blown art market in this country. 2002, 2003, it was Everard Reed, Goodman Gallery, Sally Thompson, and a couple of museums that worked. There was no platform for seeing this stuff. So it was a kitsch project, but it really did its job at the time. And this wonderful opportunity to have the medium of television, real-time, and then some of these housemates, like, interacting with it. So just indulge me. I'm watching it on Saturday morning. I'm watching Big Brother. And the housemates are really drunk. They're in party mode. They're in the jacuzzi. I think it was in the morning. The boys play a trick on one of the women in the jacuzzi. She doesn't have any clothes on, so they leave her there. They nick her clothes. So she panics, and she gets up onto the wall, and she grabs Isolde Krams's plastic elephant. And she uses it to cover the front of her body. At which point I go, okay, this can't be happening now, because they're touching the art in relation to water, which is a problem. So the artwork is going to get damaged. So I phone Big Brother, the dude who's playing the voice, I knew him from the Market Theatre. I said, this can't be happening right now. And true's God, I call, I say, make this stop. And then the Big Brother voice comes over and gets there and says, you can't be playing with the art. I mean, come on. If that isn't the most wonderfully kind of opportune moment to curate in real time an interaction with art, you know. So that was probably the beginnings of thinking about the public realm as the medium for production and publishing.
And Trinity have played a larger than life role in public art in Johannesburg over this period. How did you go about engaging with the city through Trinity, and what was the vision that was driving it?
Well, first of all, the creation of the Trinity Session came at the end of my tenure as gallery manager, curator of the Market Theatre Gallery. And I had a huge amount of experience working in the CBD and in townships surrounding the city, curating artists from those places into the Market Theatre. So in terms of curating and traversing new geographies, because it's not like it was a common thing for white people to go and hang out a number of these neighborhoods, because there wasn't a culture of that kind of interaction. So I was very privileged to have that. And seeing the end of things with the Market Theatre, knowing my time was up, I took a retrenchment package. They didn't continue the gallery again. I knew this was all on the horizon. Clearly, what was going to be the kind of next move from a survival point of view, and self-organization made the most sense. Collectivity made a lot of sense. Working together made sense. And the Trinity Session was formed out of three headspaces in a way. I mean, it's important to also acknowledge some other people, Jose Ferreira, Susan Glanville, even Wayne Bark at that time. We were all talking about that stuff in the late 90s. But it was really Catherine, myself, and Marcus that came together. Marcus from the digital space, early online web kind of territory, which is fairly new territory in South Africa at the time. For me, it was always an interest in urban built environment. And Catherine was very much research and reading territory. And of course, forensic pathology and criminology and so on. So there was a lovely meeting of minds in that. The first 3 years, the Trinity Session was very much, we worked almost exclusively in a kind of electronic art space. We did a lot of gigs with Transmediale, Ars Electronica, and so forth. And it was pretty cool. And it taught us a lot about thinking about networks, making connections between people and ideas through what the underpinnings of the World Wide Web might represent in terms of an exchange space. But I think that the decisions one makes about practice or thinking is also predicated on the sort of circumstances and rapid change that was taking place at that period in the early 2000s. Joburg was getting itself together. We were getting wind of sort of overtures from city in terms of placemaking ideas, in terms of urban regeneration, culture-led urban regeneration. There was, of course, lots of language like new urbanism bandied about in those days, phrases nobody likes anymore. And it felt we had a calling to the city. The city, as the one I was experiencing in the early 90s, was an infinitely more interesting space in terms of cultural production than what we might necessarily consume at that time in galleries or museums. And of course, the Biennales offered very interesting context for thinking that way. But in the main, there wasn't much stuff to plant your work or ideas to. So to the point about circumstance, our first office was in Greenside. It was unbelievably interesting. So indulge me, because this is a slightly long point, but this is the story in a nutshell that gets us to the city and the public art thing. We're based in Greenside. It's our first little office. We all have our own salaries coming in, and we're paying the rent. And then we get a couple of gigs that start paying the bills. But more importantly, we get a call from the late Antoinette Murdoch, who was chair of the Civic Theatre Gallery. Can you come to a meeting with us? We need help with our gallery plan. You guys seem to know what you're doing. So we go there, we have a discussion with them, and we come up with a business plan to, you know, salvage the gallery's trajectory. We get called to a meeting with the then CEO of the Civic Theatre, Bernard Jay. None of the board from the Civic Gallery rocks up. We're sitting in the meeting, and he says, well, they haven't rocked up, so now I'm dealing with you guys. Do you want to run this gallery? And we go, well, we're actually looking for offices, and we'd like to be in the CBD. So he says, well, how about I set you up with the gallery and I get you offices here? So we moved to now the Joburg Theatre. We've got this fabulous basement space to begin with for the first year, which was on the P1 parking level. It was a brilliant kind of little bunker space, right? Super cool space. Well, a year into that, Bernard turns around and says, look, Sappi needs a basement parking, and I'm getting the South African Ballet Theatre Company to move here, and I'm going to build spaces for everybody, yourselves included, but I've got to shut you down for a year. The trade-off was office space. I think we paid rent in those days, and we got a new gallery built for us, free. And off the back of that, the Duty Street Trees were produced, and then we facilitated the creation of the competition that led to Clive Vandenberg's Ierland, and in a way, the rest is history. But that period of Greenside to Braamfontein 2002 up until 2008 was a critical period for us to engage with the city as material, to learn to become a consultancy in a way, and we got more and more projects. And in a way, the rest really is history, because those projects continue to inform our research agenda. The outcome was less important than where we were doing the work, because how better to learn about post-apartheid suburbs, townships, and city than physically work in them and work with communities and design and hopefully do some good work.
Looking back, that period when, remember, the going slogan was world-class African city,
yeah,
and there were all these projects, and Trinity were very much part of that, I think, optimistic view. How do you feel now looking back? And Joburg seems a much grimmer, less optimistic place. You know, people sometimes refer to world-class African city, but it's always with a ironic, embittered tone.
Well, indeed, you know, I think most people would agree that probably the best mayor of Joburg was particularly during the sort of up to the World Cup era, I think sort of mid-2000s, was Amos Masondo. And the world-class African city thing, I think, was very attached to his agenda. And then for a period, much later on, the Metro removed world-class African city from the Joburg logo. Okay, because they couldn't stand up to that thing. And I think it's returned again. I seem to recall. I can't remember. Always dealing with that stuff. But to be honest, I mean, I'd be curious to know what Joburg would be like if there wasn't a pandemic. Things were already on the slow slide, if not the fast slide, down to hell by 2019. But it's a pretty devastated environment now due to political, the kind of corrupt politics, corruption of the flows of money through council, and fuck all leadership.
Well,
in our own personal experience, you know, if you say policies are only as good as the leaders that implement them and see them, whatever, if one thinks of the public art policy for Johannesburg, which we were instrumental in talking to and working with other partners to realize with the city of Joburg, Stephen Sack, Eric Itzkin, and those people. You know, there was a time when that was deployed in such a strategic and radical way that there was a proliferation of work for the creative economy that was next level. Everyone's lost touch with that sense of things. Well, the priority is not that. We know that. Politicians are not interested in their people.
Yeah, a great pity. But let's speak more about your own artistic practice, and particularly the way that you've used your practice as social commentary. And you've often spoken about the interest that you have in artists playing a role in warfare, and a rather paradoxical role through camouflage.
Yeah.
And there was that great era pretty much leading up to the First World War, when a lot of modernist artistic techniques were deployed on the battlefield as camouflage. And how has that influenced your practice, and how have you explored that in your work?
The thing is, I've always been interested in the biology and the physiognomy of sight and seeing. So traversing a city like Johannesburg, especially if you're preoccupied with the threat of a smash and grab or just poor performance on the streets or wayward jaywalkers and the like, you're always on edge. You're almost in a battlefield of sorts. And so the kinds of, if one thinks of ideas of deception, perception, and so forth, I can't quite remember how I gravitated to artists creating deception in the battlefield, where it first emanated. But certainly in terms of my early photography, where I was constantly walking the streets with my camera, and I became really enamored with the reflection of buildings in glass curtain walls and so forth. And so this idea of the city distorted through mirror reflections in glass skyscrapers is an obvious form of camouflage. And deeper research into more technologized forms of, you know, tanks that can disappear because they have nanotechnology in them and all that kind of stuff becomes really interesting. But it was the low-tech stuff that was done in the First World War and towards the Second World War that spoke to a kind of, in a way, a kind of tragic space where fighting the enemy and deploying whatever tactics you need to manage that and succeed, there's a lot of pathos in that space. There's a lot of tragedy, and there's a lot of trauma, and there's a lot of pain. So on the one hand, there's the aesthetic project. And what's always interesting to me is that Jackson Pollock's art master, Thomas Hart Benton, who made some beautiful prairie paintings and the like, as soon as he was conscripted, he became a camoufleur. And then you go into an understanding of the role that artists play, or any body, any physical body plays within the war machine. That the military is very good at auditing the grunt from the officer and so forth. And so I was never conscripted. I managed to dodge my call-ups. And it's not that I was preoccupied with Bush war and that kind of stuff in the 80s. I was, in a way, too young to really understand it. But if one thinks about the state of emergency, 85, 86, the bombings that took place, my parents being caught in a bomb blast in Hyde Park, wanting to leave the country again, South Africa was a battlefield, you know. Obviously, that's latently embedded in the thinking. But it becomes more interesting when you yourself are playing in your little city golf, a kind of hide-and-seek with the city itself. So soon, one is looking for visual languages that you can draw parallels with. And to that point about the pathos and all that kind of thing, I mean, I became so fascinated with particularly the First World War spaces of innovation. I mean, if one looks at just where plastic surgery really did some of its best early work was with soldiers who'd had parts of their faces blown off and so forth and then are reconstructed. I could go on. But the presence of artists, if one thinks of the Ghost Army of the Second World War, the Americans who were there to create weaknesses within the front, and they did so in three ways: misinformation, sound installations, and fake armories. So if you were doing reconnaissance flights, if you're the Germans flying over a part of France or something, whatever, there'd be an inventory of inflatable tanks and fake aeroplanes. So that's one form of deception. The other one is to deploy the sound of tanks moving in that part of the front. So the Germans might be distracted. You create a gap in the line. It's like rugby, you know? And this is really fascinating.
And actually employing that kind of thinking in physical projects around Johannesburg, Pretoria, I always remember the Dazzle camouflage in Aubrey Faurie's, that miniature gallery that he built inside a projection.
Indeed. Yeah, the Dazzle camouflage thing, again, I forget where I came across it or whatever, but in early research, the graphic optics of disguising a ship at sea from a torpedoist, a U-boat torpedoist, is the principle, right? And some 440-odd merchant ships and defensive ships were painted with these experimental paintings. An interesting, fun fact, of course, is we only had black and white photography in those days, and in actual fact, those paintings were very garish. The treatment of the ships themselves was in high coloration. But the principle was disguise the bow, disguise the stern, long-range firing. Typically, you have to fire ahead of your target. These are relatable ideas, driving down Jeppy Street, trying to navigate a jaywalker who seems to resist getting out of the way. I draw a complete connection with that. And also, if you think of, I suppose, genuinely how snipers work, you know, they have a spotter, there's the sniper himself, and there's a target. When you get into the very long-range stuff, the guy who's firing, shooting the bullet can't see the target. He's following coordinates, and like the longest range shot is over 3.5 kilometers or something like that. You literally can't see it, and this target has to walk into the bullet. This is morbid, of course, and macabre, but I find direct correlations with how we spatialize a drawing. Maybe that's not as good an example as how you are thinking about your body in space as a target or in relation to a potential threat. And all the other camouflage that you have to use to present as not a target. So your body language shifts, your sense of confidence, particularly if you're experienced in this, that if you've been held up at gunpoint before or had an attempt at stabbing or had car accidents and dudes descend on you. I had lots of that in the 90s. And I think that's a key part of it. I had so many brushes with kind of violent experiences, held up at gunpoint, these horrible things. But they taught me lots of powerful lessons. And as an artist, that's, I think, surviving traumatic experiences in the absence of other language systems to help you process that is hard. But artists often will gravitate to their own language system to process that complexity and find a way to communicate it, or not directly, but they have other language systems and tools that can be used as coping mechanisms.
It always seems to me an interesting paradox between the artist as someone who's attempting to reveal a truth a deeper truth about circumstances, about a situation. Yeah. And the artist who employs camouflage to disguise the true arrangement of things.
Well, you know, only up until getting into my 50s and the kind of medical challenges I've had my entire life that has formulated an understanding of myself and the fact that I'm amazed by the fact that I'm still alive to this day and I can maybe look forward to futures that I didn't think were possible maybe a couple of decades ago, I'm more open to the idea of talking about very personal exchanges and experiences. Before, I'm talking 5 years back, 10 years back, it was important for me to distance myself, my own subjectivity from the subject I was interested in. So I think camouflage became literally the visual language of camouflage, conjuring my own visuals from the city and from places that I was analyzing and studying and documenting to create camouflage-like representations was denying the audience access to my personal story. It was actually a protective mechanism. I didn't want to tell you what I was feeling. What I wanted to do was conceptualize the feeling in relation to how urban spaces produce abstraction in us. I'm talking alienation, isolation, and so on. So like my suicide film, Ponte City, Mikhail Subotsky produces, I forget his collaborator now, produce a kind of socio-anthropological reading of a building. It makes perfect sense. It's what you do as a documentary photographer, artist, and so forth. I was interested in one thing. This building prompts suicide. And what a beautiful way to talk about the failings of a modernist vision in the 70s when the whole idea was like self-contained utopic living, albeit for those who could afford it. And wow, within a short space of time, it's a death machine with everything else in between, the drug lords and all that kind of stuff. But Ponte really served as a perfect example of that abstraction. The average person just projects their fears onto this thing. You don't really know what's going on inside it. And yet there are real people struggling with real issues. There's the cop aspect, there's the gangs, there's the prostitution, there's the drugs. And then there's you visiting Ponte and the guy who's erecting the Coke sign from Netanya Signs is saying, oh no, we've witnessed 2 suicides in the 6 months we've been installing this thing. And you go, fuck me, that's really interesting. This vertical structure that is completely anti-human.
And it's that combination of the ultra-modernist vertical structure with, at the bottom, it's raw Johannesburg rock, which is what the suicides are plunging their 54 stories.
The thing is that some people have jumped out from the outside, right? So it's much more public. So there's this public-private tension, which I spoke to. You know, we see Ponte City on the horizon line. It was so notorious in the 90s and so forth that everybody kind of spoke about it and had an opinion. But no one had really visited the place. I used to visit it every single month for 6.5 years to pay my rent. I was living in Illovo, but I'd go there once a month to sign a check and give it to the property managers. Completely circumstantial, but brilliant, because the Ponte City is a grid in and of itself. You can read it as a map. There are many ways in which you can understand it through its kind of architecture. Plus, I also had personal relationships with people who were involved in designing it. So you then start having these somewhat intimate relationships with buildings.
The other trope that seems to have really informed the way that you relate to Johannesburg as an artist has been the notion of the fortress city and the defensive structures that predate 1994, but that have persisted and even extended in the post-apartheid city.
More so through a kind of psychological and literal gating. So the way that the bad boys in Hillbrow that do good work in kicking out or at least managing the slumlords in relation to buildings that are trying to offer, you know, good residential opportunities, take a somewhat militaristic approach to it. We're talking about rationalizing entry and exiting, turnstiles, everyone's accountable for IDs.
That's what's happened with Ponte.
Totally. So you've got that as one kind of example. But if you think of some of the most iconic, in terms of spatial planning, militarized townships, if one can describe it in that way, with roads that lead directly into a central point, so we're talking radial planning, but like a town in France or something, or in Paris. So you've got turning circles and then you've got lines of contact. So it's path of least resistance in and out. And it's a form of surveillance, right? The moment you get into that center, there's a panopticon, you can surveil the unrest Okay, so that planning of townships with that kind of optical technique is divisive and repulsive. Add high lights and constant illumination and people may as well be in a frickin' prison. So this was all part of surveillance culture during the apartheid era. But what's fascinating about Joburg is it's less that Joburg presents, the CBD presents bona fide walls, but it's more the tension between non-space and occupied space. And if you extrapolate that, it's the use of golf courses and buffer zones to keep people out. So these are passive boundary lines, or the use of a highway system to create a psychological break. And the moment I think the M2 East-West was erected, whatever it was in the 60s, that was already a clear statement that Indians who historically had been trading in the CBD and continued to do so, but then would go to Mayfair or Fordsburg or whatever, that highway, I don't think that was a passive intervention. It was, you belong on this side and we belong on that side. And we can see this plotted out throughout the city and throughout the country. If you go to the extreme version in Jerusalem, in Israel and so on, and you really start to look at walled cities, or in Belfast, of course, with the Peace Wall. But I mean, you know, that Peace Wall closes at 6 o'clock at night because the Protestants and the Catholics give them an opportunity to give each other a clap. I mean, it's amazing that that is still the case to this day. All right. So it's those divisive techniques that are more invisible than visible as installations in inverted commas that unconsciously control us, or we are unconscious to how we are controlled in that situation, which is camouflage. It's reductive to say that, but there's the visible and the invisible. And then knowing the power play in that space is really, I suppose, what was interesting. And it's so ephemeral.
And in the work that you did as Trinity, particularly the public art project, I know most of those were commissioned, but did you actively see yourselves as contesting or challenging those power structures, those lines of surveillance and fortification in the city?
You know, the way that we addressed that notion and that reality was less about making the work respond to defensive planning and so forth, but rather spend our time talking to people about their lived realities and empowering through that dialogue and art making moments, hopefully over a durational period. I'm talking about more than 1 to 2, 3 year kind of program where you're really building connections with each other. If anything, in my own practice, it was about the spectacle of the fallout, okay, which is everywhere. In the context of a collective working, you have a different responsibility. It's not about your personal interests. It's actually about what's in service of the community, the client. It's that bigger kind of paradigm of accountability to the money, to the timeline, to the construction project and so forth. So your responsibilities are very different in that context. Yeah, and one has to be careful when a piece of work triggers your own personal interests as an artist, because it's not about you. Those public art projects were about, where they were community-centric, were about those people. But if one thinks of a township like Noordgezicht, which is roughly a 1 square kilometer township just on the other side of the Soweto Highway next to Orlando West, you have Pennyville just on the opposite side. That township, first of all, didn't exist on the apartheid spatial planning maps until, I think, 1968. So this is a non-visible, this is an erased community. Majority colored, more of a black population on the other side of New Canada Road. The optics of a neighborhood invisible to the later planning of Soweto is really interesting, and that's what grips me. So that, to me, talks back to the defensive thing, the visible, the representation, the invisible, the way in which the little township itself is planned and its proximity to ways in and ways out of Soweto. But the job is different. The job is to listen to people and try to do something meaningful and authentic through that exchange of stories.
And Stephen, to push further on your own practice, in some ways I would think of you as, you know, what Rosalind Krauss talks about, the post-medium artist. And you've worked in an absolute proliferation of media, from, you know, traditional media such as sketching and linocut and painting and assemblages and sculptures, right through into video art and, of course, your Ponte 9mm cinefilm. How do you decide on what medium you're going to use for a project? And how has your approach over your career changed with regards to choice and deployment of media?
Well, I finished third year as a painting major. My fourth year, I was still registered as a painting major, but I was making all of the Capro and Matto Clark references and even Eve Klein and so forth. I mean, I set my studio wall on fire on the outside. I was making ice sculptures that disappeared before my lectures could get there. I was kind of making not a non-art, I was making kind of situational, site-specific installation stuff, okay, that was very site-responsive in particular. By the time I finished and started working at the market, I was seriously into experimental film and a lot of photography. It's interesting, 2007, I go to New York, I'm hanging out with, via a friend, Jeff Koons, and I'm going to all the fancy openings and being introduced to some very famous people, and I fly back to Joburg after a gig in Philadelphia, very, very depressed, not sure what's going on. And I was confused about whether I wanted to be famous like Jeff Koons or something else. And it occurred to me on the plane that I had spent so much time in the 90s and early 2000s thinking that conceptual art was the way to do it and non-representational stuff, even though video and photography is, but it was about that abstraction that I think I spoke about earlier rather than literal representation of lived experience. I thought, no, man, why am I so upset? I thought, I've spent so much time documenting the city, producing like folder system upon folder system of a vocabulary of decay and the like. But actually why I was taking those projects is because I was interested in producing a drawing off that or a sculpture or an installation. And what I was really angry with was that photography and video made me lazy. And I actually needed to come back to my hands. I hope the microphone can hear this. To that point, it then became very clear to me that I need to relearn how to make art. There's no shortage of ideas, but I need to learn how to express that through material. Because after all, in a way, I think that's what we do. And I set about a series of projects over 3 years, three solo shows, and just started teaching myself how to make the kinds of things that I was inspired by via the photographs of the city and so forth. And by that stage, come, you know, the mid-post-2010, the tweens, you know, then it was full on. And actually you, gaining a confidence around learning to make then frees you up to then return back to video and photography. And those things are still very much a part of my life. But I've always been interested in scale. And what I mean by that is, for a long time, studio practice didn't feel comfortable to me, but working in the city, in construction projects, yes, producing pieces of public art, felt like another dimension of materiality. And when you make enough pieces of public sculpture that each one in its own right bespoke, every conversation around engineering it in terms of how you design it, fabricate it, and so forth has similarities but is different. And that was a conscious decision for me to add that into my practice so I could know how to build in the built environment. So I think media for me is not the question. It is what is the medium to express the idea most effectively through or in? I do a lot of talking. I do a lot of presentations. I find talking is a very important medium for me. Articulation and wordiness sometimes is as much part of that as drawing on whatever I feel I want to work with, you know?
One of the pieces that struck me in your latest exhibition, the survey exhibition at Vitz Art Museum, Man Shouting in the Distance, was that whiteboard
right. That
had just been marked up. What was that about? Was that something that came out of the talking, or was that about trying to represent the pattern of ideas, the network of connections?
I'm an obsessive list maker and mind mapper. And what the market theatre taught me was how to program. I taught myself Excel, taught myself how to schedule things because I had to. And I scheduled a lot of shows over the time I was there. So the discipline of organization became ingrained in me in a pseudo project management mindset, which became very real when you start working on construction sites and making public art. So the whiteboard thing is a nod to the way I've always thought. And I believe an aesthetic I introduced into the Trinity session in the early days, which was about, if you want to think through something, plot it relationally. And a Venn diagram or a mind map is a very useful and fast technique to do that. And then you list yourself to death off the back of that. And usually it can lead to actionable outcomes. That aesthetic was part of the Trinity session in the early days. We mind mapped everything because there was so much going on. And you needed to truly understand this cultural landscape by doing so. And then you would formalize it, write it up, put it into project plans and so forth. But that rawness of spilling out onto a whiteboard or otherwise needed to be acknowledged in the context of the Wits show, because this is a survey show of 30 years worth of work, but I wanted to treat it more as an autobiographical thing. I'm well aware of the fact that it's hard work for a lot of visitors to that show to try and understand why one thing is next to another. On the other hand, I would say that's nonsense. Just trust what you see, apply your own language to it, and you will define the meaning. Fact. And I can prove that by running a workshop to show you how to do that. You don't need a lesson in art history or contemporary art to do that. But in the context of the whiteboards, I wanted to draw on the fact that essentially my CV is has three lines in it, if you will, or three pathways. There's my own practice. There is the collaborations I've done with Marcus Neustetter over 15-odd years, and then there's the work as the Trinity Session. Now, it's a bit radical to try and produce three CVs. So what I wanted to do with different colored pens was draw the geography, the territories, the kind of intellectual property space, and allude to projects with a view to, again, dispersing or decentralizing the viewer's direct understanding of what that is, but leave them to join the dots. And that's important. And that goes back to the grids and the gray dots at the intersection, you know, where the grid optic produces the illusion of a gray dot popping up in some of my artworks. I'm always diffusing and refocusing. It's very important to do that. That's our lived reality, I think.
And talking about refocusing, you made a very profound shift when you and your family, your wife and daughter, moved to Ireland in 2019. And then you were actually trapped in a Cork bungalow in rural Ireland for that entire period of the lockdown. Yeah. And that seems to have resulted in quite a significant change that led you now into the experiments that you've been doing with bio art. Yeah. So can you talk, and also about the meaning of bio art for you, and particularly the kind of relationship to living things as a medium?
Right. The move to Ireland and the desire to live rurally, our kids were of a young enough age for us to imagine this kind of greener pastures, permaculture, residency, transdisciplinary space. That's what we wanted to do. And there's lots of that in Ireland. But everyone fantasizes of the permaculture project and so on, which I think is important in and of itself. So that was the vision. We get there within 4 months, we're locked down. Thankfully, we were living in a bungalow rurally, so we could access the outdoors. But, you know, if you get told by the Irish, God bless them, in the Republic, you can't travel 2 kilometers in a rural part of the world, what does that mean? Because you're not interacting with anybody. Why would you control the social distancing that way? It's absurd. So there was a lot of militaristic stuff and mapping, and I looked deeply into, you know, a lot of theaters of war at that time. So the exposure to that natural world, our landlord was an 8th-generation dairy farmer. So this dude's entire existence, one dude, 150 cows, and he's got to be in connection with that ecosystem and natural world 24/7. Because he doesn't have a mechanized parlor, so he's got to milk the cows more or less himself. That's 2.5 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, and he's out in the field, and maybe he can get to have a pint late at night. So this dude is completely connected to the weather system. It would be like being out at sea 24/7. Just learning from that sensibility and how that natural world and all the people that occupy that space, and of course it's an industrialized space. This is no longer nature. I mean, 80% of Ireland's rivers are completely polluted. You know, they don't have life in them anymore. So that tension between the ideal of the rural and the reality of the rural, and perceiving green all day long, that is the primary color. And I don't mean one kind of green. I mean, like, the full spectrum was just, it's a beautiful thing. And I'd forgotten about that until I returned last year for a show there. But Ireland attuned us, well, first and foremost, to forests and the natural world. My wife became obsessed with mushroom hunting. We watch a Stamets TED talk, wahaha, you know, big epiphany. Then Fantastic Fungi, I think, comes out later that year. My wife is already kind of hunting, not foraging and cooking, but just hunting. She goes off on that trajectory. We get into this thing, come back to South Africa, somewhat wounded and broken from a failed attempt to create a life there and in South Africa. And it just seemed logical that the value of a green world, in inverted commas, was a necessary way of surviving, getting back into Johannesburg, and thinking about that as a window onto a mental health thing. We were all shattered in one shape or form as a consequence of social distancing and the like. And I became very concerned with, not concerned, passionate about what a mycelial network means in the wood wide web sense of it, if I'm quoting the Merlin Sheldrakes of the world. And what it means to be earthed. You know, we did all the usual stuff. We grew our own vegetables there and all that kind of stuff. And we were constantly in contact with nature. Then you come back to this brutalized, neglected, like doubly fucked up than before you left the country, city, and you despair. And what we held on to was the power of living systems to connect us. It's as simple as that. But you asked a question about bio-art. So at the time, I was working very closely with a former colleague at the Trinity Session, Pauline Borton. She and I were working on this Green Projects program. And in that space, we met a lot of different disciplines, permaculturists, play therapists, psychologists, and ultimately mycologists. We were introduced to AfriFungi. We set up some exchanges with them and learned that they had a lab. One thing leads to another. They now have their lab in our workshop in Orange Grove. And seeing them practice with mycelium for functional outcomes, for growing or making mycoproduct is one thing. I was very interested in how I could harness the mycelial network to my own artistic interest. And to come back to this business of working with materials or being post-media, I've always made miniature gardens, often battlefields and kind of pseudo-militaristic spaces, bunker systems and camouflage and so on. And they're kind of design thinking processes for me. So, and that was pre-2019. So I've always been interested in how to work with that as a medium in and of itself, which requires a tremendous amount of experimentation and more failure than success. And I think that the beauty, painting is, I think, probably the hardest artistic practice there is. It's a freaking nightmare. It's hard, 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 because every mark you make, unless you get it right, feels like a near-death experience. It's so freaking painful. And to get that practice going, you get the hand in flow, is hard. But the reward of struggling with mycelium, and when you least expect it, your shiitake mushroom pops out, and you can eat this thing, and you know of its health benefits, you're in a much broader dialogue with body, mind, soul, all of those kinds of cliches. And at 52, and coming to terms with some of my own medical lived experiences, and a big part of the reason for me finally surrendering to moving to Ireland was that I knew it would probably be better for me health-wise. 25 years at that point of working the streets of Joburg was hectic. You know, there's a weightiness. And I remember 4 months into being in Ireland, I think the pandemic hadn't quite been announced, I felt Joburg falling off my shoulders. And to be released from that, released from the responsibility of working the city and making a contribution to it, was very freeing. So coming back to South Africa, I came back with new knowledge. And it's a knowledge that you can share with people. And in a way that participatory design is such a powerful tool for education and co-production and authorship and so on, I think that the mycelial world and growing mushrooms and eating them and deploying them through artistic and scientific inquiries gives me more feedback than the conventional artistic practice that I'm accustomed to.
Why did you call that, I think that was your first exhibition with mycelium, the one at David Crutt. Mm. Why did you call the exhibition The Visitors? What's that got to do with mycelium?
Terence McKenna will argue that this planet was terraformed by mushroom spores that came in via a meteorite and so forth, and the rest is history. Arguably, that's not true, but they are growing lichen on the International Space Station outside. I think space is minus 260 degrees Celsius. So it's possible that fungi and bacteria can coalesce on the outside of the International Space Station. Okay, so McKenna is one starting point. The terraforming thing is just an interesting idea if we think about the evolution of the planet, of an ecosystem, of a breathable planet. There are, of course, fossils of supergiant mushrooms from, the Cerulean era, 500, 600 million years ago. These are 4 meter high, 2 meter wide mushrooms. Okay, so these things were there. So that's a speculative play. The exhibition uses basic AI tools, Midjourney and the like, to produce visualizations that are a rereading of an urban context. So I'm back in the urban space, but I'm using mycelial or fungal behaviors as the lens for thinking about urban space. So we have various stinkwoods in our road in Linden. And right outside our house is one being attacked by a Ganoderma destructans, which is a a reishi mushroom. The fruiting body is so freaking big. The ones I've collected, they are a spectacle in and of themselves.
I found ones up in observatory that have been attacking trees, and I never knew what they were till I learned about your work.
This particular mycelial network does not necessarily give back. It will eat that tree to death. The root system will fail, or it'll decay at the base and it'll collapse, who knows, but the tree will die. Anyway, collecting the mushrooms in and of itself is very interesting. And then I'm back in Joburg, I'm feeling alienated. I don't quite feel like Joburg's my place. And what a useful thing then to have this parasitic mushroom kind of transforming, terraforming Linden, okay? When I did some drawings of Linden, just as the layout plan of the township, if you will, and a kind of pseudo-topographical rendering of one of the bigger mushrooms I'd collected, and I put it in to Midjourney, it spat out defensive city plans. I'm talking like medieval walled cities. Now, this is fantastic, right? To the earlier point in the discussion around defense of Joburg and the gatedness of Johannesburg, well, it's not just the gatedness, it's the psychology of gatedness. It's the psychology of distance and abstraction from the other, right? And our inability to connect with one another. So the fear factor becomes important. So I really wanted to riff on the idea that there's a terraforming mushroom in our neighborhood attacking one of the biggest man-made forests in the world. Go into a deeper dive around forestation in Johannesburg, and essentially it was there for the mines to begin with. Linden was planted as a cherry orchard. We have the mycology lab, and our workshop is in Orange Grove, the site of the original citrus farm of Johannesburg. I've done a lot of oral history work in my public art projects around that stuff. So it felt like The Visitors was a way to connect my interests, in this case a suburban reality. One typically has always lived in a suburban context and then works in the CBD. But the insularity of the suburban condition, and yet the looking for connection, the mushrooms are the mechanism to do that. And you do enough reading and enough picking up on the absurdities, because it's such an unknown world. Most people are kind of respond to mushrooms in one of two ways. You look at it and you'll die, or you look at it and you'll get high. Now, both of these are problematic. They're both equally true, but they're not true of every freaking mushroom. So the tendency to want to kick a mushroom just because it's there, because we are told it's a dangerous thing, becomes a very interesting way of understanding how we really think as human beings. Make enough myths around anything and you can produce enough hate to fuel the next fucking generation. And that's what the social mycelial network offers up to me, connection as opposed to a dystopian disorientation.
Stephen, that was a really good discussion.
Thanks very
I've learned
much,
a lot.
Sir.
You've been listening to a dialogue between myself, Krista Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts, and my guest, the Johannesburg independent artist and urbanist, Stephen Hobbs. This podcast was hosted and produced by myself, with technical production by Elna Schutz. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Lee Rosevier and is used under a Creative Commons license.